I would like to quit dropping my cane. I'd like to have Cindy come up here and give us some convention announcements. And she's right here.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Are we on ACB Radio?
Yes.
All right, welcome ACB Radio.
Yay!
So, a couple of important announcements. The scholarship reception this evening is taking place in Olympic instead of the Forest Room. So Olympic is where exhibits were. That's where the scholarship reception will be. Got it?
Yeah.
Okay. our banquet will be in Silver Gold, which is where our main meals have been. And another change is our silent auction is going to remain in Spruce. Lisa has done a phenomenal job on getting that set up, and we don't want to have to move everything. So it's in a nice, you know, you can move around the room in a nice circular way and just mosey around the perimeter of the room and check everything out and get your bidding in. The change will also be that the silent auction, instead of opening at 6, will open 1 hour following our business meeting. So if we end at 4:30, it will start at 5:30. If we end at 4, she'll be in there at 5. Any sighted volunteers willing to be in there to help during that time would be appreciated. And we know that that's also when the scholarship reception is going on. We don't want to dissuade anybody from going to that. But there's options, and if people want to get in to check out the silent auction before they go to the scholarship reception, we hope we'll have opportunity for that. Lisa, are you in the room?
I am right here.
Okay. So Lisa is going to read a few of the items that we that need a little love and attention. But before she comes over and reads those items, would you guys, this is an incredible job she's doing. Would you help me thank her, please?
Thank you, Cindy. We have 52 items this year, and some of them were just added yesterday morning. So there are a few items that haven't even got a bid yet. I started them out low for everybody to have a chance at some of these really, really good prizes. And everything has been donated by individuals or by a couple of vendors or by chapters. And it is our fundraiser to put money in for our budget. So we have lots of gift baskets. We have a Seeing Eye GPS XT software package available that you put on your iPhone. We have a dolphin speech. Okay. Dolphin Supernova magnifier and speech pen. So you can put that software on your computer at home, and you have the flash drive for any computer, any Windows computer that you might need to use at your parents' house or your library. There's lots of baskets, big gift baskets that are, you know, pretty pricey with lots of goodies inside. Coffee, there's something with wine in it. There's some handmade items. Dan Lovell has, again, been very generous and donated a lot of pens, styluses. There's a watch. We do have a Victor Stream and a convention quilt. There's just a lot to see, and I will be there 1 hour after the business meeting closes. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. Okay. And then just to remind you that our lunch, there's going to be two lunches today. The guide dog users luncheon program will be across the hall in Oak Pine, where the breakfast was this morning, and the general lunch will be in Silver Gold, right next door to our left. We will have volunteers throughout the day, and so and if you're in the room and you're a volunteer, we appreciate you. Some of them are our own conventioneers who work so hard. So anyway, that's all I have. Just remember, reception is in Olympic, and the silent auction will be in Spruce, and will be in Silver Gold for the banquet. All right, thanks. Have fun.
Being from Federal Way, we do things a little bit different than backwards sometimes. You hadn't noticed? I completely forgot the Pledge of Allegiance, and I would like to ask Braden to come up now. I've asked Braden Eggers to come up and lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Perfect. You do know it.
Good job.
Braden told me he didn't know the Pledge of Allegiance. I think he just proved that he does. All right, I am again honored and privileged to introduce Mr. Paul Edwards, a former president of the American Council of the Blind, to give us a report on what's happening at ACB. Paul?
And I'm going to steal this. Is this mic working well enough, you guys?
Yeah,
all right, cool. So thank you again for listening. There are a couple of things that I want to be sure to say up front. The first one is I am a has-been and an old fart. And that means that at least to a degree I'm not a part of the inner circle of ACB anymore. I'm not on the board. I am on the board of publications. So while I've certainly kept up with what's going on in ACB, there may be some newer and more exciting things that are happening that are being discussed this weekend that won't be included in my report. The second thing that I want to say is obviously the opinions that I'm expressing are Paul Edwards's and don't necessarily reflect on the national organization, though I don't think too many people at the national level would disagree with too many of the things that I'm going to say. So ACB is like every other membership organization in the country today. It faces immense difficulties. There is no membership organization in this country that hasn't lost members over the last 10 or 20 years. And it's not necessarily or even primarily because we're doing anything that is abhorrent or wrong. It is that the mindset of people in this country has fundamentally changed. We've done a lot to try to counter that. And in a few minutes, I'll be talking a little bit more about that. But the truth is, it's hard. I don't know for sure. For a long time, Washington was bucking the trend so that you guys were actually making the rest of us look bad by increasing your membership. I don't know if you're still doing that. Yeah, good job. So give yourselves a hand because that's really unusual. Washington has two folks who are extremely active at the national level. One of them is not here because she's active on the national level, and that's Denise Colley, who is now a member of the board of directors of ACB. She seemed to know the guy who was serving before her on ACB's board. His first name is Burl, and so it seems like they're keeping a seat open for the state of Washington at the national level and making a huge contribution. But Deb Cook Lewis was elected to the Board of Publications last year and has for the last year done an immensely good job there. I cannot tell you what a difference Deb has made in terms of the capacity of that organization to get ahead. She's taken on the job of being secretary for the Board of Publications, but more importantly, she took on the task of running a complex exercise that involved trying to gather information and herd buffaloes concerning large print. That information has now been gathered, and the information has now been synthesized, and the chances are over the next few months you'll be hearing more about what kinds of recommendations the Board of Publications will have with regard to the way that we implement large print at the national level. But what's more important from my perspective is the way that Deb managed over the past year to keep everybody on task and to get an immensely good job done. So let's hear it from Ms. Deborah. Thank you. So, in terms of talking about the national scene in terms of ACB, I think one of the most important things to probably say is that ACB has entered a period of intense self-examination. And that's probably the right thing for us to have done. You know, I've said that our membership is declining, and I would also argue that the degree to which we were recognized and valued by the rest of the community, whether it's the blindness community or whether it's a broader disability community, was also being pretty severely impacted. Eric Bridges, who is our executive director, actually managed to rope some funds that enabled us to start a new long-range planning program. And what they ended up doing was developing and implementing a whole new set of priorities. And those priorities essentially meant dividing the board and other people who've been invited to serve from other parts of the organization into five groups. The first was affiliate membership. And ACB has wrestled with the issue of affiliate membership ever since it started. We started, if you guys remember, because it was our view that affiliates didn't have the strength that they needed to have in order to make ACB a democratic and viable organization. There are some of us who believe that we've probably gone too far in strengthening the rights of affiliates and need to perhaps give a little more in terms of creating a national center. So the affiliate membership group will certainly look at that, but they'll also look at other questions. What should affiliates expect? What ought to be the difference between state and special interest affiliates? Should special interest affiliates have the same power as state affiliates? Are there things that affiliate membership, so that members' organizations should expect from the national? Are there things that the national should expect from affiliate members? So I think all of these are questions that we're looking at the moment. The second area is the area that Deb and I are perhaps most involved in, because the Board of Publications, at least in a sense, is a part of Marketing and Communications, which is the next subtitle of the long-range plan that ACB operates with. But it's more than that. Thank you so much. It's more than that, because Marketing and Communications also asks, who do we want to market to? Is it blind people or sighted people? Who do we want to communicate with? Is it blind people or sighted people or both? How do we enable appropriate communication to both groups? What does appropriate communication to both groups represent? Can we go on marketing ACB the same way as we always have? Or do we need to develop and implement some new approaches that will focus on trying to make what we market more saleable and trying to make sure that we communicate the messages that we want to make? For old people like me, things like Facebook and Twitter continue to be somewhat like the foreign languages I didn't study in school. And yet, there's no question that for most people under the age of Paul Edwards, Facebook and Twitter are appropriate and effective modes of communication, and we need to do better. Cindy came up to me last night and asked if I was on Facebook, and I said, yeah, but I never looked there. And she says, well, I can't even find you anymore. But clearly, one of the things that ACB has done a better job of over the past few years is beginning to strengthen the degree to which we're becoming more active in both of these areas, and also encouraging the increase in the number of people who hear our messages, because people are listening to Facebook and Twitter, and for the most part, they aren't listening to email anymore. The third section of our new long-range plan is convention and meetings. And on ACB has probably made more progress over the last 5 or 6 years in developing partnerships that have made our conventions richer and fuller than they had been before. Aside from the price of hotel rooms, they've actually made them cheaper, too. Lovely. And me without my spoon. But there are still questions that surround the convention. To what degree should the convention remain at the center of what ACB does? Should we do something to assure that folks who are unable to come to convention because of how expensive it's become have more say in the way the organization operates? Should we develop a system of remote voting? We've certainly experimented with it. I think that the jury is at least to a degree still out there. There are some of us traditionalists who think, to a degree, you've got to pay to play. And if you want to have a voice in this organization, it's not good enough to stand at a far distance. You've got to demonstrate some kind of involvement and stick-to-itiveness and commitment to ACB before we cede all of the responsibilities of electing our leadership to you. But I think that view may well be in the minority, and I think we're probably going to find that in the next few years we develop a system that actually gives more power to folks at home. And maybe you guys in Washington will love that. Here's a glass of water. Thank you so much. I'm about to tipple a little bit, ladies and gentlemen. One moment, please. Yes, that's much better. Yes, very good. Now, if you just put a little vodka in it, it would have been so much more pleasant. Well, the fourth category that we ought to talk about a little bit is development. And it does not have anything to do with exercising muscles. No. It has to do with finding money. And the truth is, it's not an easy thing to do nowadays. ACB has, for the past several years, operated with deficits that have not put in jeopardy, but certainly required us to use some of our reserves. I'm happy to say that last year and this year, ACB operated with a balanced budget and really did very well. (Clears throat) I think that's a huge tribute to what folks have been able to do at the national level to develop and implement some new and innovative ways of raising funds. I have fun doing one that I do out of Florida. There is a group up in West Palm Beach called the Cavallino Classic that holds a luncheon every year in January. And for the last 10 years, I've had the privilege of going up there and talking about ACB to these guys. They're an amazing group of people. They're people who can afford to drive Ferraris and Porsches and cool stuff. But for the last 10 years, they have given ACB each year as a result of that luncheon at least $25,000 a year. Last year, Eric Bridges went with me, and I think Eric's planning to come again this year. I think he's afraid that I'll get old and die, so there needs to be somebody else to take my place. So the last part of the ACB implementation plan is, for an old campaigner like me, the most important one, and that calls itself advocacy, policy, and legislation. And when that group began to work, they discovered that there were probably 30 or 35 areas that there were resolutions that were actively opened or policy elements that ACB was actively working on. I think that's important and I think it's relevant, but I would like to see us, and this is Paul Edwards speaking, this isn't necessarily the national board, but I would like to see us focus more on some of that, because I think one of the ways that we can meet the other four criteria is by being more active in this last one. I'm not sure we've done a good job of persuading some of our members that there's a lot out there that needs to be done and that we need their help to get those things done. And I'd like to see us reaching out more to try to focus on specific advocacy components that we can encourage ACB members to get involved with. Some of the legislation that we've been working on over the past few years repeatedly is beginning to bear fruit. We're beginning to have more recognition at the national level that we need to persuade Medicare that just because it has a lens, it's not a pair of glasses. We're beginning to, I think, have more luck in persuading folks that not everybody who receives car donations is a crook. And we're beginning to do a better job, I think, of persuading people that the specialized needs of blind children in schools need to be recognized along with those of deafblind folks by developing specific blindness and deafblindness related legislation with regarding to the education of blind kids. All of those things are wonderful, and I think as they move forward, we'll have more things to work on. But I think there's lots more areas that we can begin to combine efforts with our affiliates to make things better. I'm going to make this relatively short so that I leave some time for some questions. I think my view is that ACB as it stands now is an organization of which we can be proud. But what makes us able to be proud of ACB isn't so much what we're doing at the national level. It's the fact that we have affiliates like the Washington Council. So as I end what I'm going to say, and perhaps have time to open it for a couple of questions, what I'd like to say to all of you is give yourselves a hand. You're the heroes. They're not awake yet. Oh, good.
Coming.
I was afraid I was going to have to sing.
You had your chance last night.
Particularly given the way my voice is today, I think you guys should be very glad I didn't.
So, my name's Doreen Cornwell from Seattle, and I really appreciate this
Hi.
Update. I have two questions. I don't know if I'm going to, both of them are going to make it out of my mouth. How is ACB interacting with the current fiscal environment as far as federal budget and wanting to eviscerate Medicare and Medicaid, eviscerate social net safety net programs, divert a whole large percentage of the budget to the military? How is ACB engaged about that? And I got to say, in Washington, we're really lucky because I think a lot of our state government has made big efforts to make the legislative process, make it easy to participate online in the legislative process. And I'm wondering if ACB is doing anything to monitor that nationwide. I think those are, I probably have more questions, but that's enough to start.
Cool. So let me deal with your second one first. ACB has certainly been involved in looking at all of the approaches that are being taken to try to make private and independent voting more easily available to folks who are blind. Some of us, and that really includes me, are not convinced that online voting is ready for prime time yet. We think that there is still a good deal of room for interference, and that we're better to stick to systems that create independent and accessible voting machines with a paper trail that allow folks to cast their votes privately and independently and know that they can be verified and counted. So, yeah, I agree. With regard to your first question, I don't know that there are a lot of organizations that are having a lot of success in terms of communicating with the current administration. We still do not have a commissioner of the Rehabilitative Services Administration. Most of the positions that relate to people with disabilities are unfilled.
Wow.
And many of the people, many of the people who have been put in charge of programs have expressed an interest in the past in seeing those programs go away. So I think the only thing that I can tell you is that we in ACB have recognized that whether we like the current administration or not, we have to A, recognize that it's there, and B, we have to try to look at the new climate and determine how best we can interact within that climate. And so what we've tried to do is to stick with some of the things that we have been doing over the past several years and recognize that this is probably not the time to try for new initiatives. But obviously, in all of those areas where there are efforts to cut down on programs that affect our folks, ACB has been out there with everybody else to try to make sure that those programs are protected as much as we can protect them. And the good news with regard to all of that is just as the current administration is not doing a good job of making the changes it wants to make, it's also not doing a good job of taking away the programs that currently exist. So the bottom line is, as long as there is a stalemate of inaction, we probably should consider ourselves lucky.
Coming. We have another question.
Here we go. I am having trouble keeping up on the latest updates on this, but I've heard that there is possibility of the ADA being severely eliminated or disbanded in some ways. And I think you answered my question in what you just said. It's a stalemate, so nothing's happening. But can you give any insight to what is going on with that? Because some people are unaware it's even happening.
Yeah, I don't think we're at the stage where the ADA is being eliminated or seriously impacted. I think the area that we have concern is an area that's popped its head up over the past 4 or 5 years. And that is the degree to which, in terms of the enforcement of the ADA, particularly Title III entities, are essentially saying it's not fair for people to be picking on them because they're really good people and they like folks with disabilities and we're just not being nice. And it's only been 27 years since the ADA was passed, so surely you ought to give them a little more time. So I think if the Congress ever gets to the place where it passes a piece of legislation, that's going to be the kind that it's likely going to pass. And the problem with some of that is it's unclear exactly how far people will try to take some of those things. So the ADA is at least to some degree affected in a broader sense because some states have begun to look at changes of the law that will affect the degree to which businesses and even public entities have to work hard to make websites accessible. And perhaps more importantly, we still don't have a final, clear, unequivocal statement. And to be candid, we need to blame the Obama administration as much as the Trump administration for this, of the degree to which the internet is covered by the ADA. The sin of this country is that all the right questions were asked in 2010 and they were answered. And almost 8 years later, we're still waiting for Washington to recognize and accept the fact that more and more people are shopping online, and damn it, blind people should be able to do that by themselves.
Any other questions?
Coming.
Got one.
Okay, I saw this man's hand first, so here we go.
No?
All right.
Sue?
Paul, can you give us a little info about the National Convention in St. Louis? I don't know if you know anything about the hotel or... anyway, any good dope you...
It's a nice day. I was actually at the ACB of Illinois convention a few weeks ago, and Chris and Marvelena Gray were there. And I did listen to his presentation. He indicates that the hotel is really nice, that it has several restaurants in it, that there are a bunch of restaurants very close to it, that it's modern, that its internet access is good, that they're already planning a bunch of what they think will be exciting tours. There's been some talk of doing a tour that would go to some of the birthplaces of Abraham Lincoln. There's been a talk, they're talking about doing a tour of the St. Louis Zoo. They're talking about doing a number of tours to different ethnic areas of St. Louis. There are apparently German neighborhoods and Italian neighborhoods, you know. So we can get all of the different kind of food, you know. So I think it'll be a cool convention. The good news is the Cardinals are in town. So I don't care what else is going on. I'm going to the game. but I don't know as much as I probably should. Everybody who is at the board meeting this weekend knows a lot more than I do. So when Denise gets back, tackle her, make her tell you all about it.
Questions?
No other questions?
Okay, coming.
Okay, and Sue, could you make your way to the podium, please?
Oh, hi, this is Dan. I just have a question. I don't know if it's really pertinent or not, but for as far as job searching, when you have an interview and, you know, you go in and, because I've always debated whether I should take my cane or not, because on the one hand, if I go in and I don't without it, then it's like you're hiding it. But then if you go in, which I've done predominantly, it's like you can just tone their voice right away. Thank you for coming in, but sorry. And then the other is they look at me and they don't come out directly and ask it, but it has to do with age. You know, like you're getting toward, you're towards the end of your career.
Well, I hope I'm at the end of my career. but who knows? When they cut Social Security out, I may have to go back to work. But there's this really cool corner near my house, and I have some pencils. your question is a serious one, and there are divided notions of what the right answer is. For me, the right answer is you walk in with your cane. It's my view that we need to be proud of the fact that we're blind, but I think you also walk in with other proofs that you can do the work. And even if they're minded to dismiss you, kind of insist that there are things you want to show them that they need to understand about you that will tell them why you're a good person to hire. And most of the time, because you have that white cane, they're going to say to you, well, if you have to, sir, go ahead. And then it seems to me, at the very least, you get a chance to try to at least show folks that most of the stereotypes that they have about blind people aren't right.
Yes, there is. The stationary mic. Yeah, we got one more question.
Coming.
One thing I wanted to mention to you that I've noticed in my chapter is, and it's on the voting. A lot of our members are very upset about this have to vote by mail. And it feels like, you know, first of all, you may not have someone at home who can read that stuff to you. But second of all, it took away our right to be able to feel like we were voting. And I'm just wondering what you think of that, because I kind of, you know, a lot of people, it's important to go to that booth and vote. And they spend a lot of money in this state for machines that they're not using. And people don't like to do this voting from home business.
I am entirely in agreement with you. However, what I will tell you is there is a huge lobby out there of individuals who want to sell online and mail voting because they have a chance to make money, and their primary way of selling it is to say it's cheaper. They haven't proved to me that it's accurate. They haven't proved to me that people can't cheat using it, and they will never prove to me that it makes that it makes any sense to change from a situation where I just got 20 years ago the capacity for the first time in history to vote on my own privately and independently in the way I wanted without asking anybody for anything. And I think that what we need to do in this state and everywhere else is to form alliances with others, and there are lots of folks out there. The ACLU is certainly one organization that is, and there are a lot of other groups who are working in electoral reform who will tell you and work with you to prove to the state that the approaches that are being taken to voting now not only don't work, but they're an insult to the independence and intelligence of every voter in the state.
All right. Thank you very much, Paul. And you'll have another opportunity this evening at the banquet to hear from Paul. Can I have Reg and Sheila work their way up to the head table, please? And while they're doing that, we'll have a door prize.
All right, our first door prize.
So we just need Sheila. Oh, here comes Sheila.
There's a door prize of $20 donated by the United Blind of Tri-Cities, plus hugs and kisses from Yakima Valley Council of the Blind, $10 cash, and Hershey's hugs and kisses. And then there's a goodie basket of, looks like, mint, spearmint, a nice warm hat, candy, and a coffee mug.
And the winner is Rex Ransom.
I'm right
here. All right, take that on the airplane, Rex. For those of you who don't know, Rex is a member of WCB but resides in California. So we thank you for being such a strong supporter of our organization. For our next segment, I would like... I'd like to introduce Sue Imeter, who will facilitate our next session entitled Things People Do. Sue?
Yep. I'm looking for... They're going to be...
There it is.
Yes. They're going to be standing at the podium, Frank.
Okay.
Good morning, WCB. Oh, gee, Paul didn't leave his vodka up here. Darn. You know, that's how he was when he was on the national board, too. He always, you know, just thought because he was president, he should get more stuff. Anyway, good morning, ACB World. Are we being streamed, Rick?
Yes.
All right. Well, this is the 17th annual Jobs People Do panel. So when we finish with today, we will have had, this is really novel, 3 people for 17 years. So we'll have had 51 people. Pretty smart, aren't I? Yeah. Anyway, actually it's pretty cool. Cindy made me a list a year or two back with everybody, and it's really fun to look through all the different jobs we've had and so on, and the different people. And I always find a different crew every year to represent different kind of jobs, different kinds of maybe backgrounds, things people have done with their life to look for jobs, keep jobs. So without further ado, today we have 3 people with us, to my left, so I guess that would be your right, is Sheila Turner. Sheila is a rehabilitation teacher with the Edith Bischel Center. They presented yesterday. They're doing lots of good, cool stuff over here. It's very neat. Then to my right, there is Andy Arvidson. Andy is the president of the Skagit Island County Council of the Blind. Did I get it right, Andy? Close enough? I tried to remember it this morning. I didn't think you wanted me to call you at 2:30 to ask the right name of your chapter. Anyway, and I'll let him tell you the name of what he does and his title, because I would butcher it. My Korean isn't very good. And then to Andy's right is Reggie George, and Reggie is an assistive technology specialist with the Department of Services for the Blind. So we're going to get started. We'll hear from each person, and then there'll be questions, time for questions at the end, never fear. So we're going to start out this morning with Andy Arvidson, who is going to tell you his title and the name of his school, etc., much better than can I. So I'm turning it over to Andy.
Good morning. The reason she says she didn't speak Korean is I don't think she does speak Korean.
No.
Anyway.
Not too good.
The name of our business, my wife and I have, is Anacortes Subakdo. It's a Korean martial art. My title is Sabam Nim. Sabam Nim is like having a PhD and a master's certificate for teaching. It's teaching teachers. Subakdo, our martial art, is anybody familiar with Chuck Norris? It's what he got his master's degree in. So, Su means hand. Bak means strike or educated, so I have an educated striking hand. And Do means way. We're part of an organization called the Mudaquan. Mu is military or martial. Which is the characters in that mean have a stop sign and a sword, so we stop inner and outer conflict. Muda Kwan the Dok is virtue, so we're a school of, and Kwan is institute or school, so we're a school of military virtue. So we try to stop. Our mission statement is world peace. Have you ever known a martial art that talked about world peace? Anyway, give you a little history. When I was a little kid in elementary school, I wanted to be a teacher when I grew up. And I got sidetracked and became a logger and a construction worker instead for a long time. And then I started losing my sight in my late 20s. And I went to the Department of Services for the Blind, went through OTC, and then I worked there for a while for Bronson Gu and Carl Jarvis for 4.5 years. And then I went to, left there and started my own business. And then I've been married more than once, so like a lot of people. Anyway, my ex-wife, after Colette and I got married, we were married about 2 years, my ex-wife called and said, would you let your son Joey come and live with you? He was 6 years old. He lived in Mount Vernon and we were in Seattle at the time. So when he came down there, he was very intimidated by anybody because he had been abused, and I hadn't known that until he moved in with us. And I asked his mother, how long do you want him to stay? And she says, as long as he's happy. And so he moved out at 18. But anyway, because he was so intimidated by people, he would cower and hide from people. We got him into martial arts to give him some self-confidence. And then my wife started with him, and then I started with him. I didn't do it because I didn't think blind people could do it. And let me tell you, I'm not the only blind martial artist. I've discovered a lot of other blind martial artists, not in the art I'm in, but in other arts. So in 1997, I started in this. So it's been 20 years this year that I've been doing martial arts. And in around 2003, I became a certified assistant instructor, went through a program to do that. In 2005, in January, I tested for a certified instructor, internationally certified, and we opened our business on January 11, 2005. We decided to start our own school. Our instructor was getting old, and we wanted to share the art, so we opened another school. And then, of course, we lived in Laconner, and my bus, we were teaching two nights a week. My bus ride was 4 hours, or three hours to go 14 miles. And so we decided, we were renting, paying rent for a place to teach two nights a week, and we decided to buy a home that we could put a studio in. And so we found this house with a semi-attached garage, two-car garage. And so we put in a bid on this house in a great location. You have to drive by it to go to the community center, the swimming pool, several schools, Boys and Girls Club, where everybody had to pass by us. And so, but one stipulation is to start a martial arts school, we had to get an okay from all the people within 300 yards of our home. And the city said it could take us a couple months. So we exercised our advocacy and went out and talked to all the neighbors ourselves. We could have opened a school, any kind of school except martial arts. We could have opened a mortuary or a photo shop or whatever without permission. So we went throughout the neighborhood and asked everybody and said, oh, no, that'd be great. That'd be great. So we went to the city and said, everybody says we can do it. So we got this house, and as soon as we bought the house, we had to go take out a second loan because we had to dismantle the garage and build a studio. And we created a slideshow of this video, and I started practicing my kicks and demolished the garage. I did most of the demolition, and then I did the electrical and the floor. I had a table saw set up, so I was running a table saw, and we had all these video or slideshows. And the grand master of our art started wanting more people to open studios, and they said, if the Arvidsons can start a studio in their garage, you can too. And so it became the START program. START means share the art. And so he borrowed our slideshow and took it all over the world and showed other people how we started our business. I felt pretty honored about that. We also, in 2006, received a plaque for leadership, each one of us from our federation. I thought back about when I was a little kid and wanted to be a teacher, and I've kind of done some of that stuff throughout my life. But now I really get to be a certified instructor. We've been doing self-defense courses since before we even opened our school. And now I'm in three different elementary schools in our town. As I said yesterday in here, some of the schools didn't want anything to do with this. I talked to one of the principals. What I didn't share yesterday is I actually went to school superintendent. And he said, I think I should have all of our PE teachers come to your school and learn a little self-defense. So we set up a date and nobody showed. But now that I met the PE teacher, I had the hardest time getting into his school because I'm in three of them, and this is our fifth or sixth year in the schools. Last year he said, maybe you should come to our day meeting where just the teachers are there. And so it's getting back to where I had gotten with the previous superintendent. We have a new superintendent that I haven't talked to, but we've also been able to let high school students come in and take our classes for PE credits for school. So we've made a big change in our community. When I first went to the superintendent's office with my guide dog and sit down and talk to him, I said, you probably think it's funny that a blind guy is teaching martial arts. He said, I don't think that's funny at all. And So I've made some outreaches for disabled people. We've got people in our school with MS, CP, cortical blindness, deafness. Our youngest student is 3. Our oldest student, well, he's not training anymore, is 87. I earlier this year started teaching Tai Chi because I learned Tai Chi as well. And so I go from hard karate to soft Tai Chi. But my oldest Tai Chi student is 89. So we've got a wide variety. In that first year we had our business open, we were up to 25 students in the first year, teaching 2 nights a week. Now, instead of teaching 4 classes a week, we're teaching about 30 classes a week. My earliest class in the morning is 8:45 a.m. My last class at night ends at 8:30 p.m. I don't have to ride a bus anymore. I walk down the hall, open the door, and I leave my house. I'm in the studio. Just open the door, and I'm there. So you don't see the blind guy driving to work anymore. I thought that because of my blindness, I could never do what I do. In 2010, I tested for my master's instruction. I tested for 4th degree black belt and my master's certification. I turned 60 at that event. And a couple years ago, I tested for 5th degree black belt level for my 65th birthday. That is an 8-day test with a lot of work prior to that test. An 8-day physical test starts on Friday and ends on Friday. And most of the days start at 7 a.m. and end at 9, 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night. And so we get to share this with a lot of people. We've been honored recently with one of our 21-year-old students was selected to represent the entire United States in Korea at a youth seminar that happens for everybody in the world. And I felt pretty honored that I was able to share with a young man that ability to do that. Anyway, thanks.
Very cool. Our next presenter. Our next presenter will be Reggie George. Reg is with the Department of Services for the Blind, and Reg and I do have something in common. Neither of our teams made the World Series. I've gotten to know Reg. She's active in Yakima. And I hear he's a pretty good musician. I may have to wander up and hear him tonight if I can stay up past midnight, believe it or not. I know people don't believe that I go to bed before midnight now, but I do. Anyway, I'm getting to be like Paul, I guess. Anyway, without further ado, I want to introduce to you Reggie George.
Hi. I want to go off script for just a second and thank Andy for that story, because I've always had an admiration for people that would start their own business in that way because of a vision. You know, when you could stay in a comfortable career and do something because it's, you know, important. So I'm excited to be a part of this panel. And many of you I've served in some capacity in the past or hope to have the opportunity to in the future. I tell people that becoming an AT specialist means that I've finally found my life's work. Only I didn't realize that for a long time. My journey to this career has been anything but a straight path. Learning Braille at an early age and having supportive parents who believed in me and support from teachers, friends, and family were at least as important as anything I've been able to accomplish on my own. So what is an AT specialist, you might ask? The definitions I found were way too difficult to read or explain. I see my work as a part of the team that helps people to find the answers to succeed in the areas of employment, education, independent living, and integration into their community. It's more than just thinking I'm a good JAWS or Zoom text user and enjoy training people. My job involves traveling all over Eastern Washington, training clients and coworkers, writing articles and tutorials, networking with TVIs and college student disability coordinators to provide materials in accessible formats, ordering equipment and monitoring federal and state training contracts to make sure that they adhere with guidelines, working with employers to analyze work site needs and to find creative ways to put our clients to work. Also, participating in outreach opportunities like this one to find others who can benefit from our services. The work is exhilarating, challenging, fun, and fulfilling. I have been blind since birth, and I've always had a fascination with music and electronics since the first time I could remember, when I still wondered if people lived inside our TV set. I was spanked at the age of 4 for playing with the telephone, because I would call anyone who would talk to me. And then I was lying about it when I was caught. No, I wouldn't play it on the phone. We had an old organ in our house that was plugged into a floor outlet. I remember playing with the plug, and it hissed and shocked me like a snake. And after I ran crying to my parents, I never got my fingers between the prongs again. And that really is like my first memory. In first grade, our teacher wanted to record some poems that we had written, but the microphone had a bad connection in the cord and just wasn't working properly. I suddenly realized that a set of headphones might work as a microphone with the tape recorder. I mean, the plugs were the same. They both used small speakers to move sound waves in or out. I mean, it made sense to me. At the time, I had no idea why it worked. I only sensed that it might and tried it. So another quality you need is a willingness to experiment to find workarounds that others might not think of. For example, I wasn't happy reading this in Braille, and so I'm using the Victor Stream as a line-by-line prompter to do this today. As a kid, I had no access to computers. It was too soon, so my interests revolved around audio equipment and amateur radio. The next step was learning from older friends how to set up an underground radio station at the Kansas Blind School. Boy, that was fun. One of my favorite blind bluegrass musicians, Doc Watson, took over their school's transmitter and, according to legend, got kicked out for it. That was in the 30s. Luckily, that didn't happen to me. In high school, I learned to play games and perform word processing on Apple IIe computers. I'm dating myself. I was also introduced to a piece of technology that has influenced many of us ever since, and that was the Kurzweil original reading machine that cost around $50,000. I spent many happy hours making it do things that it wasn't supposed to do. you could make it sound like a train. But I also used it to do my homework. We were told someday this would be small enough to fit in your hand, but we never believed it. Having a playful attitude toward technology and looking at challenges as something to be overcome, or becoming frustrated like my wife, those are other qualities that can help on this path. I became a musician and played keyboards in many types of bands over the years, eventually graduating from college at the age of 27 with a degree in communication studies. When I went to work in collections as a telephone representative, I found out that the information technology staff was not going to be much help, as they had no idea how my software worked or what it could do. This forced me to reach out to developers for technical support and teach myself to create macros to become efficient on the job. That was in the DOS days. Learning became a matter of survival, and I really enjoyed it. As other blind people got computers, I was able to help them to master their computers so that they wouldn't have to work so hard. I discovered that I could remember and apply what I learned to other situations. A turning point for me came in the year 2000 when I started traveling on my own dime to assist visually impaired customers I met who owned Gateway Computers where I was working at the time. I wanted to gain more experience by teaching them the basics and resolving their worst problems. I felt bad that all that money had been spent and they could not use their equipment. In hindsight, I could see that a drive was building in me to find a way to work in this field, but I honestly never thought it would happen. I had pretty much resigned myself to working as customer service representative, which is not a bad thing, but it's not where I was at. As time went by, I continued to make connections with different agencies and people in the field. Living in the same place long enough for people to know you and recognize the quality of your work can be very helpful in opening doors to other opportunities. I landed a contract as a trainer with Columbia Lighthouse for the Blind, and then contracted with other agencies and even school districts after passing more testing. While until recently there have been no degree programs to enter this field, this is finally starting to change. Earning certifications from AT manufacturers and nationally recognized standard bodies can help you determine if you have the aptitude for this type of work. Other helpful certifications are the many offered by Microsoft, Apple, and Google. These are important because they demonstrate to employers that you have a deep background knowledge of the hardware and software that we use every day, and that you can pass tests and you are serious about keeping up your skills. You have to somehow differentiate yourself from all the people that might think it's a glamorous career choice or easy money. Trust me, it's not. Some assets that are helpful to anyone considering this field include being an active listener, caring about people more than the technology, having a good memory, being organized and understanding how to manage caseloads of 40 to 60 people over a period of years, and being able to explain complicated concepts in simple terms. You don't want to lose people in terminology or tell them more than they need to know to make informed choices. Let your client figure out what works for them. Don't lead them to a certain conclusion just because you think it's the right one. Allow them to discover for themselves what works, and you will often end up learning from your clients. AT specialists must have strong ethics and an ability to set boundaries. Everything we do as a public servant is a matter of public record and must be above reproach. I was told do nothing that you might not be comfortable seeing in the newspaper the next day. And it can happen. I thank you for this opportunity to share a small part of my story. And I want to lighten this up just a bit. How many of you know of Jeff Foxworthy? Because you might be an assistive technology specialist if. You enjoy getting electrocuted. That's how my hair got so curly, I think. If you walk around every day carrying 3 phones, 2 computers, and a tablet. If you don't mind spending 3 hours on the phone, allowing a 9-year-old to walk you through installing software on their parents' computer, then writing a detailed report about the experience the next day, you might be an assistive technology specialist. If you could explain to a student that the inexpensive CCTV the school loaned them to see the board will work just as well as the $4,000 CCTV they wanted you to buy for them. If you genuinely care about giving people the tools they need to live independently, maintain employment, and follow their dreams, and you don't mind putting the work in to get there, you might be an assistive technology specialist. Thank you.
Terrific. You know, when I first called Reggie, he said, well, I haven't given a speech for a long time. I don't know how I'll do. He did darn good. That's what I got to say. And he and Lisa actually relocated to come out here. You know, it takes, I think, a certain amount of courage to uproot and come halfway across the country for a new job. So I respect, that's one of the things that I respect people willing to do. That would be tough. Our final presenter today has gotten to be a friend of mine because not only is she a very busy lady, she'll tell you everything that she does, but she also serves on the State Rehabilitation Council for the Blind and on the State Independent Living Council. So Sheila and I, since we have to travel to the SRC meetings, we usually join up, let's see, is it called the bar? Oh,
yeah.
Anyway. So Sheila and I
remember.
Yeah, she can't remember. Sheila and I have become good friends, and I'm delighted to have her on our panel. So here's Sheila.
Thank you, Sue.
Got it?
Yep, I got it. I'm going to take it out of the stand, though, because I'm just an improv kind of girl. I want to thank you, Sue, for inviting me to be on the panel today. I also want to thank everybody for traveling to Pasco. I have a sense of hometown pride because I've been here for 41 years. So we are delighted to have you in our lovely, lovely town, and I hope you're enjoying our beautiful weather. Anyway, I'm a little bit humbled to be up here, being the tail end of these two gentlemen who have very impressive stories to tell, and I hope that maybe you'll learn something from mine as well. I'm originally from Spokane. Yay, Spokane! my parents moved here when in 76, and I was 4 years old at the time. I am a product of 3 generations of blindness in my family. In my family, my mother was born with bilateral congenital cataracts. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with that. Possibly you have the same thing. But it has to be, first of all, she didn't know it was hereditary. It never popped up in the family before. And so they didn't really know what to do with her. My grandma spent a lot of time doing things for my mother because it was just easier. So my mother didn't really even go to school until she was 9 years old. and she wound up going to the State School for the Blind in Vancouver. And I know it well. I've got my own stories to tell about that one. I didn't set up a pirate radio station, but I did get into my share of trouble. she went there, and then she graduated. She came back to public school, and she graduated from Rogers High School. Yeah, I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with that, class of 1959. She met my father and, had my older sister, and she was blonde-haired, blue eyes, not a speck of cataracts at all. My mother went to 5 different doctors. They said, oh, no, what you have isn't hereditary. No, not at all. My sister was fine. 2 years later, here I come. What you see before me, cataracts in both eyes. So for those of you who are not familiar with it, you have to have it removed as soon as possible for the best results. Well, 45 years ago, they didn't do surgery on babies. So they did my surgeries 6 months apart. Well, with congenital cataracts, if you get it removed, you can secondary cataracts can grow back. You have scarring, which results in postoperative glaucoma. Lots of different wonderful side effects happen, which all happened to me. So by the time I was 2, I had had 5 different surgeries for the cataracts and the secondary cataracts and the glaucoma. And when I was 8 years old, they attempted a cornea transplant, which resulted in a hemorrhage in my right eye, causing me basically to lose all the vision in that one. So after that, my mother was like, nope, no more. She's got what she's got. But I grew up in the Pasco public school system. I was probably the only visually impaired person in the district when I first started school. And my mother was the biggest advocate for me that there ever, ever was. She raised me to be a good one too. And the teachers would ask her, well, how can Sheila learn? How does Sheila learn? And she's like, I don't know, ask her. You're the teacher, put the tools in her hand and see what she does with it. My mother never allowed me to make excuses for myself. There was nothing that I wanted to try that she would not let me try. If gymnastics, right, well, that was a bad idea. Ballet, another bad idea. But if I wanted to try these things and I decided that I couldn't do it, she made me make the phone call and quit. She made me tell them, this is why I can't do what I can't do. And that made me take responsibility for that. When I learned how to read and write, I learned how to do it in both print and Braille. Braille is something that it's better to have and not need than need and not have. And everyone should learn how to read Braille. I am a huge proponent of literacy and accessible media in whatever form it may take. So I learned how to do that. I learned how to type as well, and thank God, because next thing you know, 10 years later, everyone's using a computer. So I learned how to do all those things. I was educated in the public school system until it got pretty hard emotionally, and I'm sure all of us are familiar with that. I did go to the State School for the Blind for about 1.5 years. It was a little bit too sheltered for me, and all of my friends who were much older than me graduated, and I did not want to stay there. So I came back here, went to Pasco High School, go Bulldogs, for about 1.5 years before I wanted to drop out and get my GED. I was not getting the help that I needed, was not getting what I felt, it was time to take a pop quiz. Oh, gee, sorry, Sheila, forgot to get yours enlarged. Go down to the office and get it done. I fought tooth and nail even to get a 2.9 GPA. So I wanted to get my GED, but surprise, they wouldn't let me because I was only 16. And if the district failed a blind person, where's all the funding going to come from next time? So they gave us a lot of fights about that until my mother stepped in and said, look, you let my daughter drop out and get her GED or I'm going to sue you. And I did. I wound up getting my GED 1 month before I would have graduated. And I went to a wonderful college right across the street from here called Columbia Basin College. And I got two different degrees from there, one in Associate in Arts and Sciences, one in Associate of Human Services. If you had told me when I was growing up, especially in my punk rock days at the blind school, if you would have told me that I was going to be working with blind people, I would have told you exactly where you could stick that idea. It was not what I wanted to do. I mean, it was so stereotypical. It was like, why don't I just become a piano tuner? And there's nothing wrong with becoming a piano tuner. It's just that that's pretty much what somebody would have expected me to do. My original goal was to be an interpreter. I studied French and German and Spanish, and that's what I wanted to do. Then I wound up getting married and having a child and realized I wasn't going anywhere. So I needed to find something to do around here. So I had my son, and I thought, maybe I'll be a stay-at-home mom. No. A blind person can't very well be a stay-at-home mom. And why is that? Because no one delivers anymore, at least not here. There's no milkmen. Doctors don't make house calls. Even when you homeschool your kids, you don't technically homeschool them because you're taking them to the gym, you're taking them to HomeLink, you're taking them to everything. So that didn't work. So I needed to find something else to do, and I started taking human services classes at CBC. And I found I really liked it. I found that I enjoyed hearing people's stories. I found that I could help them more than I thought that I was going to be able to. My oldest son inherited the cataracts from me, and we tried everything we could do for him, but he had post-operative glaucoma. I realized that I needed to become educated. I needed to make a good living. I needed to be able to take care of myself. I was not in a very good marriage, and I needed to provide for myself and my other two children. And so I went to WSU, go Cougs, in a wonderful Richland campus, and that's where I got my bachelor's in social science degree. Thank you. I started out there, and they said, the guy who was supposed to be in charge of the disability department said, you can't take 15 credits. I said, well, why don't you let me take 15 credits, and if I can't do it, I will drop a class. I don't need you to make that decision for me. And I did. So there. No. Anyway. So my son, he lost his sight when he was 12, all of it. And I told him, I said, you know, I did everything I could. Yes, I'm the one to blame for passing this eye condition to you, but I did everything I could to stop that from happening. I got the surgeries. We did the contact lenses. We did the glasses. We did the eye drops. I said, my conscience is clear. So what you need to do now is decide, are you going to be a good blind person or a crappy blind person? Because we can only go forward from here. And he did. He did. He's now living in Seattle. He's working for the Lighthouse. 23 years old. He's starting his own business. He does bicycle repair. And my daughter came along, and she's not blind at all. Nope. And I can't wait because she's 15, and that means driver's ed. I'm going to have another chauffeur. Ka-ching. But yeah, she just started high school this year. Her little brother is 10, and he is an amazing kid, and he also inherited the cataracts from me as well. But he wears glasses, and he does pretty well, knock on wood, because he's not 12 yet. once we get past that milestone. But how I came to work for the Edith Bischel Center is actually an interesting story. I was looking for a monocular telescope, and I didn't know where to find one. I found the Edith Bischel Center, which had just opened its doors in Kennewick. And for the Edith Bischel was a woman who donated the land for the center to be built on. We sold half of that to get the money to pay for the actual building, so we don't have a mortgage. So in 1996, the center opened its doors, and it was just a little mom-and-pop operation, you know, a couple, Jerry Laborde and Jeanette Braden, wonderful people were working there at the time. They helped me get my monocular telescope, and I thought, you know, since I'm home with my son, I'm just going to school right now, you know, why don't I just volunteer? So I volunteered to teach a Saturday morning Braille class, and I had a few people. And it turned out to be pretty successful. But then they approached me and asked me if I wanted to be on their board of directors. And so I served a 2-year term as secretary of the board of directors. And it was at that time that some people came from the Washington State Department of Services for the Blind and said, hey, Eastern Washington is not being served very well in our independent living program. At that point, the Lilac Services for the Blind out of Spokane, wonderful organization, was doing all of Eastern Washington, and it was just too much. I mean, there were gaps in services. And so they said, we have 5 counties, Benton, Franklin, Walla Walla, Columbia, and Yakima. Would your center be interested in serving those counties? And I kind of held a lot of sway there and pushed that idea forward for 2 reasons. Obvious ones, that we needed the services, and 2, I needed another job. So I said, sure, why can't I do it? And a wonderful man some of you might remember named Kevin Nathan, may he rest in peace, helped me out, did the interview for me, and had a lot of faith in me, in my ability to do this job, probably more faith than I had. And 16 years later, I'm still doing it. I love this job, and I never thought I would. And I've gotten to meet some of the most amazing people, just from all over the world, from all different professions. No matter what you do, no matter how fat, thin, pretty, ugly, rich, poor, whatever, a disability is something that can happen to anyone at any time. And it does. You can see the lives people have led, their level of reserve for coping with such things, their ability to want to go on after something like that happens. And it makes me happy to be a part of it. I think the most special thing about my job is that I get to sit face-to-face with people in their own home, in their living room, in their kitchen, across their table from them, and listen to them and try to help them. And use whatever it was that made this condition happen to me to pass some sort of knowledge onto them and some courage onto them. And it could be something as simple as just putting a bump dot on the start button of a microwave, or something as complex as helping someone learn how to read Braille. Whatever it is, the needs of the people that I serve are as unique as the people themselves, and it's a real privilege to be able to do it. I've had some, okay. See, I feel like the Academy Awards. Sue's up here with that hook. She's going to grab me around the neck. But anyway, I will wrap this up. Thank you for letting me come and speak to you, and thank you for coming to Pasco. And I hope everyone enjoys the wonderful convention, and I will hopefully see most of you at the banquet tonight. Thank you.
You know what I love about this panel is we get to hear people's wonderful stories. We do have time for some questions, and if you can keep your questions quick, we'll get to as many of you as we can. I think Bruce is running around.
This is Janice Squires from the Tri-Cities, and I have just a real quick comment and a question for Sheila. We just want to let you know that with the new director and Sheila and all their hard work, that the Bischel Center has just gone from night to day. And Sheila, you know, I think what I'd like to ask you, if you could just comment quickly on the things that you're doing at the center. I know besides your job with your classes and your support group, if you don't mind sharing.
Yeah, thank you, Janice. Yes, our new director is amazing, and being there for 16 years, I can tell you that. It's very true. Anyway, what we have at the Edith Bischel Center, we were here yesterday with some of our inventory. We do have a small store. We have the Independent Living Program. The United Blind meets at our center quite frequently. We have a low vision clinic where the doctor comes in and assesses people for magnifiers, lighting, glasses, and things. We have fundraisers going on, social events. We have a computer teacher that's contracting with us to provide services. We also have iPhone and iPad training classes. The local Voc Rehab for Services for the Blind has an office in our building. I also have a support group for people with vision loss, and I have a class I teach called, Understanding Blindness. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
This is Nathan Brannon.
Nathan?
And I have a question for Reggie.
Okay.
And also a comment. First, I'll say with the comment that being a fellow musician, thank you for your performance last night. It was awesome. You did a great job. I love your playing. I play guitar and piano, and so and keyboards. And so my question is around that. Have you heard of the Native Instruments Complete Control keyboards and software?
Frank, can you?
I have not. I've heard of Native Instruments software, but I had no idea that it was necessarily accessible or not. I think you can maybe use some of the instruments depending on the front end that you're using. I guess people are still using Sonar 9 or 2. I don't know. Thanks. Sorry.
Well,
okay.
I just wanted to say it is actually quite accessible.
Wow.
With the,
we'll have to talk.
The new keyboards, yeah. So I wanted to mention that, and I'll talk to you later.
Okay.
Thank you. Carl. Other questions?
Yes. This is J.R. Kennison. I would like to thanks to Andy and Sheila. You would remember me from the school.
Do you have a question?
My question is towards Andy. Have you taken your business with your disability as it is down and offered it to the state school?
Not yet. We actually did BS2 program this year for the 16 to 20 year olds in Seattle for a self-defense class. Every time we come to this event, we offer an auction piece for a self-defense class for up to 20 people. So like I said, I've been doing self-defense classes for almost 20 years, so I think I have a little bit of experience.
Hi.
Sounds good. Okay.
Hi, this is Carl Jarvis. First, I wanted to thank Sue. I think that for 17 years now, this has been the centerpiece as far as inspiration to this convention. So thanks, Sue.
Thank you, Carl.
And to my old friend Andy, who, aren't we both about 30?
Yeah.
Somehow the years have slipped by. But Andy, being self-employed, I think, is challenging. And being successfully self-employed is extremely, extremely rare. And I'm wondering if you had to boil it down to one central ingredient, what would you say you absolutely needed in order to achieve your success?
A good business plan, for one. I have my spouse, Colette, is sighted, so that helps. But what we did was we went around to lots of successful martial arts schools and say, how do you run your business, before we even started? And we collected information from California, New York, Florida, Illinois, all over the place, and we put our plan together. And January 2nd will be 13 years.
Good for you.
I'm Sarah Edick, and I have a comment.
Sorry, no more questions. Sorry, guys.
Oh, darn.
We're running over time. I'm getting the hook. But these three folks will be around today and this evening, so spend a little time in thanking them for their presentation. All of you were terrific.
Thank you so much. See you next year.
Great job. And again, I want to echo Carl's remarks that I want to congratulate Sue on pulling together yet another stellar employment panel. And I want to thank these three people because I think they have proven that while others may consider them disabled, they are not. All right, we're going to take a moment for one door prize, and then we'll take a break.
Who wants coffee? Okay, so I have a $25 Starbucks gift card, and then I have a $25 cash. And while you're out getting your coffee, there's a nice warm hat to go with this. And this is going to Young Choi.
All right, we are on break for 15 minutes. We'll reconvene at 10:40. We'll have another door prize promptly at 10:40. So if you're late, you lose out.